the recording of the Robert Greenstein teleconference, the Center on Budget and Policy, PR, Monday, March 19th, 2012, scheduled for 10 a.m. Central Time. Excuse me, everyone. We now have our presenters in conference. Please be aware that each of your lines is in a listen-only mode. At the conclusion of today's presentation, we will open the floor for questions. I would now like to turn the conference over to Ms. Shannon Spillane. Ms. Spillane, please begin.
Thank you. Good morning, and thank you for joining today's call, Should IPAB Be Repealed? As you know, the House is scheduled to vote this week on the repeal of the Independent Payment Advisory Board, or IPAB, a presidentially appointed commission that the health reform law created and that will help slow the growth of Medicare costs. Joining us this morning to discuss IPAB's potential to help preserve and improve Medicare and rein in cost growth, as well as to address some misleading claims about IPAB, are Uwe Reinhardt, Peter Orszag, and Paul Vandewater. Uwe Reinhardt, a leading authority on healthcare economics, is the James Madison Professor of Political Economy and a Professor of Economics and Public Affairs at Princeton University's Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs. Peter Orszag, Vice Chair of Global Banking at Citigroup and Adjunct Senior Fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations, is a former Director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, as well as the Congressional Budget Office. In these roles, he focused for a number of years on the need for much stronger healthcare cost containment. As such, Peter was one of the proponents of IPAB during the development of the health reform legislation. Paul Vandewater is a senior fellow here at the Center on Budget, specializing in Medicare, Social Security, and health coverage issues. Previously, he was vice president for health policy at the National Academy of Social Insurance, and earlier in his career spent 18 years at CBO. We'll hear first from Paul, followed by Uwe and Peter, and then we'll turn to your questions. Paul?
Thanks, Shannon. In my brief remarks this morning, I want to correct some misconceptions about IPAB and explain why repealing it is a bad idea. Here's how IPAB will work. If the chief actuary at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services projects that the growth in Medicare costs per beneficiary will exceed a specified target, the board must produce a proposal to reduce or eliminate the excess. The board's recommendations will take effect automatically unless Congress passes and the President signs legislation to change or overturn them. Congress may substitute an alternative proposal that achieves the same amount of savings, but if Congress proposes an alternative that would achieve a smaller amount of savings, then the Senate would have to approve it by a 3/5 margin for it to take effect. Remember, IPAB serves as a backstop to the other cost containment measures in health reform. An important backstop, but a backstop nonetheless. Health reform includes several important and complementary measures to slow the growth of Medicare costs. First, it cuts payment rates to health care providers. Second, it begins to restructure the health care payment and delivery system in ways that reward high-value medical care. And third, it creates IPAB. Only if the first two approaches do not hold the growth of Medicare spending to the targets will the IPAB process be triggered. CBO and the administration both project that the other cost control measures in health reform will produce most or all of the savings needed to meet the law's spending targets. The CMS actuary projects that IPAB will be called upon to reduce Medicare spending only for 2018 and 2019, and CBO currently projects that IPAB will never be triggered. If CBO and the administration turn out to be wrong, however, then IPAB will play an important role as a backstop to control costs. Now, let's look at the criticisms of IPAB. Some critics say that IPAB will usurp Congress's role in setting Medicare policy and put too much power in the hands of unelected government officials. That charge is off base for two reasons. First, the IPAB process can give Congress the political cover to make necessary but controversial decisions that affect the incomes of powerful health care interests. Uwe and Peter will both say more about the failures of Medicare's current governance system. But separate and apart from IPAB, Congress can always enact provisions that will meet the Medicare spending targets. It doesn't need IPAB to do that, and IPAB doesn't restrict its freedom to do so. As I noted a moment ago, Congress has already taken steps as part of health reform that are expected to do precisely that. Critics also say that IPAB will ration health care. That charge is wrong as well. Health reform specifically prohibits IPAB from rationing health care, from raising Medicare's premiums or cost sharing, from cutting benefits, or from restricting eligibility. IPAB can only propose steps that achieve savings in the payment and delivery of health care services. In fact, if Congress repeals IPAB, the alternatives will likely prove far worse for Medicare beneficiaries and for health care providers. Without IPAB, Congress will more likely consider blunt proposals that would shift significant costs to beneficiaries, such as sharply raising premiums and raising the age of eligibility. Most important, repealing IPAB would fuel efforts to replace Medicare's guarantee of health coverage with an approach known as premium support, which gives beneficiaries a fixed payment or voucher to help them buy private health insurance or traditional Medicare. The federal government would save money by limiting the growth of the voucher to less than the growth of health care costs, but beneficiaries would have to pay more in premiums or get less in benefits with each passing year, which is precisely what health reform directs IPAB to avoid. Moreover, premium support would represent a big step backwards in the effort to control total health care costs throughout the economy. Traditional Medicare has frequently been the leader in developing innovative ways to reduce costs, such as prospective payment systems that private insurers later adopted. And the data show that Medicare has outperformed private insurance in holding down the growth of costs. Health reform envisions that with the help of IPAB, Medicare will continue to use its leverage to slow cost growth while improving the quality of care. In contrast, premium support would weaken Medicare's ability to promote system-wide cost reduction and is likely to result in higher, not lower, total health care costs. Let me make one final comment. I'm not suggesting that IPAB is perfect. In fact, I would make a few changes to improve it. For example, policymakers could allow IPAB to focus less on achieving short-term savings and more on slowing the growth of costs in the long run. In addition, since the growth in healthcare costs is fundamentally a system-wide problem rather than a Medicare-specific one, Congress could let IPAB make binding recommendations to reform payments and slow cost growth in the private sector as well as in Medicare. In these ways, IPAB could play an even greater role in promoting payment and delivery reforms that would slow the growth in costs throughout the healthcare system. And now, here's Uwe Reinhardt.
Hi, good morning. Well, I don't have as polished a presentation. I just want to make four points following on Paul's presentation. The first one is, if you look at Medicare as an insurance company and the House Ways and Means Committee and Senate Finance Committee and indeed the entire Congress as its board of directors, then you would have to say this insurance company is severely flawed because its system of governance is beset by incredible conflicts of interest. With Congress, you really always have to worry, whom do they represent, the people or particular interest groups that give them money? And so here you have a system, an insurance company with a board that take money from vendors to the company. That's a highly precarious situation. Therefore, one should not look to Congress to fulfill its fiduciary duties to the American people. And I believe the Congress has amply demonstrated that by saddling us with these huge deficits. In other words, they have never fulfilled their fiduciary duties vis-a-vis particularly future generations. So Congress is actually not in a strong mode to say this should be our responsibility. Now, if you had a board like this, their membership would be highly professional and have ethical strictures on them, fiduciary strictures, that made it impossible for them to be conflicted like this. For example, members of IPAB could not take money from lobbyists. Congress can. These members wouldn't. So they would be far more dispassionate in this regard. Also, IPAB would be supported by a highly competent, permanent technical staff in a way that Congress just doesn't have. They have the Congressional Budget Office, but it has its limits. They only estimate things. The staff of IPAB could be far more analytical. So that would be a good thing. Thirdly, in a way, MedPAC already showed a certain desperation with the congressional micromanaging of Medicare, and that's what we're really talking about. It is one thing for Congress to set overall budgets or overall guidelines, but Congress micromanages in the most amazing way. As we know, for example, every time Medicare has tried to do experiments with competitive bidding, Congress always intervened. And it is exactly that sort of thing that IPAB could avoid. So we already have the MedPAC device, but it has no teeth. Fourthly, I think I was very impressed, and so were my other American colleagues, on a visit to Germany, where we ran across an organization a little bit like IPAB. They take legislation that comes out of the Bundestag, and usually the legislation only says vaguely what it is the law wants done. They then write the regs, and those regs are law. They become binding, and they have a permanent staff. They have their own building, their own president, and so on. So there's precedence for having these organizations, and if you want to know how they work, you can go to Germany. Ultimately, the Minister of Health and the government do have a veto power, but usually whatever this board decides actually becomes the law. So it's not something so out of the ordinary. And then fifthly, the idea, IPAB is of course not supposed to propose anything that rations healthcare. I personally have to smile at this, because there is a kind of a naivete among people in general in the U.S. that when government withholds anything, it's rationing, but when the private market uses price to withhold healthcare from people, that somehow that is not rationing. Look at any good textbooks in economics, and the first thing we teach freshmen is the social role and the economic role of prices is to ration scarce resources among people. And that supports, of course, Paul's point. A premium support model looks to price as a rationing device, whereas the IPAB looks at alternative ways, not really to ration healthcare, but somehow to keep prices and utilization in check. So that's what I would have to add.
Okay, and it's Peter. I'm going to hop in with 4 points also. The first is that healthcare policy, if we're going to move towards a system that will deliver better value, is inevitably going to involve a trial and error process in which different things are tried, and some of them are going to work, and some of them are not, and we need a process through which we can build upon the successes. And let me give you a specific example. In January 2012, the Congressional Budget Office issued a paper that was written by Lyle Nelson examining 4 demonstration projects that had been conducted as part of Medicare. The press coverage of this picked up on the fact that out of the 4, only 1 worked, which I think is exactly the wrong perspective. The right perspective in my opinion, is one of them worked, and what happened to that one? That got almost no attention. So let's examine that particular demonstration project. The 3 that didn't work involved pay for performance. the one that did involved bundled payment, and in particular, a single payment that is a bundled payment for CABG, for coronary artery bypass grafts, at seven different hospitals. This was conducted in the between 1991 and 1996. It was called the Medicare Participating Heart Bypass Center Demonstration Project. The results showed a 10% reduction in costs for Medicare across the hospitals, with a range of a 6% reduction to a 22% reduction, and no adverse effect, perhaps even some minimal evidence of a benefit in terms of outcomes. So this is exactly the kind of thing that we need to be pursuing within Medicare in order to, again, deliver a better value proposition. So what happened? And the answer is absolutely nothing. That demonstration project was done, and then it disappeared. Nothing. There was no significant follow-up. It was not. You would think that we would have started moving aggressively to bundle CABG payments as part of Medicare policy. Nothing. The goal of the IPAB, from one perspective, is to make sure that that doesn't happen. So that when MedPAC comes back and recommends something that, for example, would follow up on promising demonstration projects like this, it doesn't fall on deaf ears. That Congress, as Chad and Uwe both made, argued, Congress can act, but if Congress doesn't act, there is some other mechanism to make sure that we can, or to try to increase the odds that we can move in the right direction. Second point is that is the goal of IPAB. It's not, many of the opponents are presenting it as being designed to produce either blunt payment reductions, or, as was already dealt with, rationing, but the rationing charges is particularly inconsistent with the whole design of the IPAB. But even the blunt payment reduction, which is what you typically hear from providers, that this is designed simply to ratchet down payments, that is not the goal of IPAB. And, in fact, Congress has proven able to do those kind of blunt payment reductions in the past. That's not the challenge. The challenge, instead, I think, is Uwe used the word micromanaging. It's to make sure that examples like the bundle payment demo get more oxygen, in the sense of get embodied into Medicare policy with a higher likelihood and more rapidly. Because if not, we're going to face a much greater challenge, both from a fiscal perspective and from a healthcare value perspective, than would be necessary. Third point. Many of the opponents of IPAB have also started to note the great deceleration that has occurred in healthcare spending, particularly over the past couple years, but even prior to that. So there was a Wall Street Journal op-ed by an AEI economist or team of economists showing some deceleration over the past decade. The deceleration has been particularly marked, notable over the past couple years. And in fact, there's a new report out from the Altrum Institute showing that year over year through January of 2012, national health expenditures rose by less than 3.5% nominal, which is very low rate of increase. My point is just many of the people who are opposed to the IPAB have also been noting the deceleration, and to the extent that the deceleration is perpetuated, the IPAB will not bind. So there's no harm, and there's, I think, some significant benefit in having, as Chad pointed out, a backstop. But to the extent that progress is being made, and I think it remains an open question how much the current deceleration reflects a cyclical phenomenon as opposed to a structural one, but to the extent that progress is being made and that part of it is structural, the IPAB will remain as a backstop that is not then invoked, as opposed to something that is invoked automatically if healthcare costs grow more rapidly. And then the final point I would make is most, if not all, of the critics of IPAB have not put forward any coherent alternative to delivering better value healthcare in the future. And this was already discussed previously, but let me just emphasize again, the leading example and the only one that has been scored by the Congressional Budget Office is the original Ryan proposal, The Wyden and Ryan alternative has not been, at least to my knowledge, not been scored by the Congressional Budget Office, and at least any such analysis hasn't been publicly released. So if you look back at the original Ryan proposal, and as the Center on Budget itself has highlighted, instead of reducing overall health care costs, the Ryan proposal involved a massive increase in health care costs for a typical 65-year-old in 2022 from about $15,000 to about $20,000, which is a massive increase. And so I think it is a fair question to ask, if you don't favor a backstop that will help to allow Medicare to build upon the successes that are inevitably as part of a trial and error process, what is your alternative that can be evaluated on an apples-to-apples basis? Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.